Chapter 12. Over the high desert, the deep sapphire sky began to darken. Casimir McFoster stood alone on one of the long wave-shaped dunes of grey sand and watched the stars emerge. It was a ritual for him now, staring up at those platinum sparks, waiting for the mighty constellation of Achilles to come shimmering out of the golden velvet twilight. When he'd found the shape of the ancient warrior and his gleaming red eye, he traced along the Milky Way swirl of his cloak. There in the sparse lower hem was a twinkle he could never be sure was real or imagined. Earth's star. She will be there, standing on cool, rich, green land, looking up into this same void, 600 years away. But I can see you still, my glorious angel. Grant me victory on this raid, even though you never believed in our cause. In Casimir's mind, Justine's beautiful face was shadowed by sadness as his task on this night became clear to her. "Choose your own path, my love," she whispered in the darkness and thick warmth of their secluded tent in the forest. Fingers lighter than mist stroked him this way, then again like so. Her delighted laughter filled the tent as he twisted with helpless delirium beneath her sensual puppetry. "Be your own man, not the tool of others. Promise me that." The pleasure she bestowed made him weep openly, swearing on generations of McFosters as yet unborn he would be true to himself and his own thoughts. Yet for all her concern, Justine did not understand the reality of this planet. Like every off-worlder before her, she regarded the Starflyer as a local myth, Faraway's Loch Ness monster. "Forgive me?" he asked of the stars. "I'm doing this for you, so you may enjoy your world and the wonderful life you have there." A tiny rivulet of sand shifted behind him, causing the faintest of sounds. Casimir smiled softly and continued to stare into the heavens. The desert heat lacked any hint of humidity. Surrounded on all sides by the Dassault Mountains, the air here never moved. Not even wisps of cirrus cloud sneaked past the rampart peaks. The static climate sucked the moisture from exposed skin and every breath. Few plants grew here, some native cacti that resembled stones and were often harder. Not even the Barsoomians could bring verdant life to a place without water. But for all its harsh nature, it was home, the place in the universe where Casimir felt most secure.
"If I were the Starflyer, you would be mine now,"
a voice whispered contentedly in his ear. "If you were the Starflyer, Bruce, you would be dead now," Casimir said. He pushed the knife blade back a little farther so the tip touched the stomach of the other young man. Bruce McFoster laughed with relief and threw his arm around his friend.
"You had me worried, Kaz. I thought you were going soft."
"Worry for yourself." Casimir withdrew the knife and slid it back into the sheath on the side of his sporran. "You sounded like a herd of T-Rexes coming up the slope. The entire Institute will hear you coming."
"They'll hear me from the afterlife. Tomorrow night we shall inflict a massive blow to them.
Did you hear the attack on Anshun damaged the human starship?"
"Scott told me." "Scott, that old woman.
Is he here? I can't believe the Elders will let him in on the raid."
Bruce dropped a shoulder and limped around Casimir.
"Mark my words," he lisped. "This Starflyer will spill your blood and tear your body apart for its amusement. Never has there been a monster so evil in the universe. I know, I faced its slaves in single combat. Hundreds of them killed, 1,000, yet still they came on."
"Don't mock so," Casimir exclaimed. He and Bruce had grown up together, shared so much they were closer than any brothers.
Yet his friend could still be incredibly offensive, not to mention tactless. Sometimes he wondered if Bruce had ever been awake at any time under Harvey's years of tutelage.
"Scott has suffered for our cause more than I'd wish."
Bruce straightened up.
"I know, I know. But you have to admit he's too cautious."
"He's alive. I'll be happy if I'm alive after serving the cause for that long."
"Keep daydreaming about your off-world nympho, and your contribution to the cause is going to be over too quickly. You were thinking about it again, weren't you? That's what you're up here for, presenting a fine skyline target for the enemy."
It was difficult for Casimir not to smile,
I was enjoying the quiet, that's all. Listening to you for the whole day before the raid would drive anyone nuts, and stop calling her a nympho.
I knew it. You were thinking about her again.
So what? At least I do care about others.
Oh, hey, below the belt or what? There have been a lot of girls I cared for in the last few years.
More than you. More, yes. But none of them for very long, eh, Bruce?
Doesn't need to be long, just thorough. Now come on, Romeo, time we got ready.
Yes. Casimir took one last longing look at the thick swath of stars, then followed Bruce as he skidded his way down the dune. Directly ahead of them was St. Omer, the great mountain that marked the most northeasterly point of the Dassault Range.
Did it help? Bruce asked, serious for once.
Or as serious as he could be. They'd reached the broad ridge of crumbling sandstone where there was a tunnel to the clan's Rock D fort. Did what help?
Thinking about her.
Some, yes. I know what we're defending is worthwhile. Casimir ducked his head to step under what looked like a deep overhang. The tunnel was underneath, hidden from the sky, barely wide enough for one person. He tucked his shoulders in and scraped his way forward, the once gritty sandstone on either side now smooth as marble from the passage of so many bodies over the decades. The tunnel bent twice, following a sharp S-curve. 30 meters from the entrance, it opened out into the first of the wide chambers that formed Rock D Fort. The guard, standing proud in her lavender and tangerine McMixon kilt, studied his face, then allowed him to pass. If the Institute soldiers did ever find the tunnel, any guard would be able to hold them off just about single-handed as they wriggled their way out of the narrow slit one by one. Polyphoto strips had been epoxied to the roof, with long strings of black electrical cable stretched out between them. Their relentless sol-spectrum light etched deep shadows across the rumpled sandstone as they led deeper into the fort.
"She must have been phenomenal in bed," Bruce said with apparent sympathy. "I mean, the two of you only had, what, a couple of days together? And you're still moping about her?
Sometimes I almost wish you'd met her.
Almost. If you'd seen her, got to know her, you would understand this isn't some easy infatuation like the ones you have, and I would have wanted my two closest friends to meet.
Oh, well, thanks, Kaz. But I thank all the heavens you didn't, because you're such an embarrassment, I'm sure she wouldn't want to have anything to do with anyone who knew you."
Bruce made a lunge for him. A laughing Casimir dodged ahead and started running.
The pair of them burst out into the fort's main chamber, still taunting and insulting each other loudly. Head swung around to check out what was happening. Some frowned at the flippancy of the youths at such a time. Others, those of a similar age, smiled tolerantly. Most simply turned back to their work. Casimir and Bruce put on their sober faces, slowed down and nodded courteously at their fellow clansmen. The rocky cavern had been carved in the rough shape of a football amphitheatre by stormwaters now long gone from this side of the mountains. Two fast channels had once merged here, swirling around and around as they clashed, before rushing out toward the northeastern lowlands. The surging waters also had eroded a host of smaller passages and caves, tributaries that had splintered and shifted as geology took over from hydro pressure. Rock D was one of the largest guardian communities, and a formidable safe refuge. There was still fresh water to be found in the lower caverns, filtering in from the mountains that guarded the desert above. Solid-state heat exchange cables had been sunk deep into the mantle below, providing power for lighting and cooking, along with the more important task of supplying the armory with electricity. All that had to be brought in was food, and that was supplied by the McCrats clan's farms and grazing lands scattered throughout the Dassault Range. Casimir felt a surge of pride at what he saw in the big chamber. If only he could have brought Justine to see this, then she would have believed in the Guardian's purpose. Over 80 fighters were busy on the chamber floor, making up one of the largest raiding parties the Guardians of Selfhood had put together in years. But then, as everyone here knew, events were picking up with the construction of the human starship. The Starflyer's long-laid plans were maturing rapidly, bringing disaster and death to the Commonwealth from the one direction no one in authority was looking. All the clans had contributed to the raid. McFosters had provided a dozen young fighters who were checking over their packs and equipment. Their emerald and copper kilts had been packed away. This evening they wore their navy blue and ebony hunter tartan, helping them pass unseen through the night. The McNoaks, also predominantly fighters, were in their grey and brown tartan. A group of them were engaged assessing the armor worn by one of their captains. The blue skeletal suit flooded the air around him with a nebulous orange haze, as if he were standing inside a ghostly amoeba. The radiance crackled and intensified each time a test penetrator cane was applied against him. With each application, the force field emitter was gradually tuned, until the emanation was nothing more than a faint, aural outline, the kind any Old Testament saint might possess. Fine-tuning inverted the radiance, cloaking him in a skin of absorptive shadow. The McConners were the third clan to focus on the soldier ethic. Their nomadic boys and girls were undergoing the same lessons, training and tests that Casimir himself had gone through. All of them he knew he could trust as much as Bruce. All were totally loyal to the cause, prepared to give their lives that humanity could be liberated. The squad they'd sent were wearing their night guard blue and vermilion kilts, along with dark leather travel jackets. Ion pistol holster and harmonic blade knife sheaths hung from their belts. The McMixons, who were charged with the keeping of Rock D and other forts in the countryside surrounding the Institute, were tending to the Charlemagnes, the war horses they would all ride to the raid. The gene-modified beasts were fully 21 hands, carried by legs like small tree trunks. They had no mane or tail. Their thick leather hide was tougher than rhino skin, and a similar dull slate grey in colour. A short unicorn spike rose out of their heads, tipped with carbon-bonded titanium blades by the Rock D. Smithy. Any unprotected human caught by one would be ripped in half. And even force field armor had been known to give way from the inertia of a full charge. Fat iron bolts had been driven through the tough shield ridges of bone that protected the neck and underbelly, and straps of leather and silicon threaded through hoops in the bolts to hold the saddle in place. The Charlemagnes had been designed by the Barsoomians in their lands away to the east of the Oak Sea. Not for money, an emblem of the culture to which the radical eco-geneticists were fiercely aversive, but for the challenge of engendering an animal that, in symbiosis with humans, had only one purpose: carnage. The Barsoomians probably even delved into the forbidden field of psychoneural profiling, for no clan fighter had ever known a Charlemagne to shy away skittishly in the heat of battle like an ordinary horse would. With their tough skin, triple hearts, and multiple stress-loading pathway skeleton, the great beasts were inordinately difficult to kill even with modern weapons. The McPeels, the widest-roaming clan of all, gathered intelligence on Institute activities from all over the planet. They also collected the advanced equipment that Johansson smuggled through the gateway along hundreds of innocuous routes. This evening, their members were distributing the final pieces of technology and weaponry required by the raiders. The McCratzes farmed and raised cattle out across faraway sweeping plains and tricky mountain pastures. They were the ones who bred the Charlemagne herds and lynx hound packs and other domestic animals used by the clans. Throughout the year, they ensured the more nomadic clans were fed and supplied. And everywhere in the main cavern moved the McSobels, the armorer clan, responsible as well for general technology. Lugging their test equipment over the rock floor, they stopped beside each fighter and warhorse, running test programs through the arrays. Scarlet superconductor cables were pulled about behind them, supplying top-up charges to batteries and weapons magazines. Seven of them had been assigned to the raid, dressed in kilts that were matte black with a plain grid pattern of thin dark grey lines and equally black coats. Five were bringing the missile launchers and medium-caliber plasma cannon, bulky titanium-cased units hanging from their Charlemagnes, which didn't even seem to notice the extra weight. The remaining two operated electronic warfare systems intended to neutralize the Institute communications and throw in as much confusion and false data as possible. Walking up to his own warhorse, Kraken, Casimir felt the goose flesh rising as the prospect of the coming raid grew more real. The Charlemagne snorted like a small thunderstorm, lifting and turning its head slightly so it could watch him walk around to its flank. Casimir had absolutely no instinct to pat the creature reassuringly. This was nothing like the normal ponies and horses he'd learned to ride on. It was enough that the beast didn't try to bite his head off on sight. The carnivore tusks, curving over its rubbery lips, were thicker than his fingers. He began to check his pack once more.
So, are you two screw-ups ready?
A rasping voice asked. Casimir smiled around at Harvey McFoster, his old tutor. The man was a veteran of many clan raids against the Institute and had the scars to prove it. Years ago, an ion beam fired by an Institute soldier had vaporized a superconductor battery beside him, and the super-energized molecules had penetrated his armor force field. After his injury, he spent his time teaching rather than fighting. He was lucky he survived the toxic shock. Clan medics spent 6 months repairing as much tissue as they could. Even so, the skin on a third of his body now had a melted appearance, and he could never raise his voice to shout. Not that he needed to. His presence alone inspired awe in his pupils. Casimir considered himself privileged to have been one. "Doing my best to be ready," he said.
"Good enough," Harvey said. "And you, Bruce, are you scared yet?"
"Ha!" Bruce gave the ion pistol on his belt a confident pat.
"No, sir."
Harvey's cheek muscles moved, his too thick skin into a grimace, looking even more like some Halloween grotesque.
"If you had a brain, lad, you would be."
Bruce's eternal cockiness vanished.
"Be nervous," Harvey said. "Their soldiers are trying to kill you, or worse. Fright is your friend. It keeps you alert. That gives you a chance out there."
"Only heroes are fearless," Casimir said, "and they die young."
"I'm glad you heard something I said," Harvey told him, "even if it is just an old lyric." "We'll make you proud," Bruce insisted.
Harvey's hand closed on his shoulder.
"I know you will, lad, although I'd prefer it if you just stay alive. Remember, keep your eyes focused in front of you the whole time, not on your dick."
He gave a labored wink toward the McNoack group, then walked off. Casimir and Bruce smiled at each other in the same way as they had when they got caught playing truant. Bruce lifted his pack up and fastened it behind his saddle.
"He's right, you know."
"I know. We mustn't let our attention slip."
"No, you idiot. About them."
"Huh?" Casimir followed the line his friend was surreptitiously indicating. Four of the McNoack fighters were young women. Casimir had even chatted with a couple of them yesterday when they arrived in Rock D.
"That one with the dark hair. She hasn't stopped looking at you since we came in."
"Andrea."
"Ooh, you already know her name. Quick work, my friend. So who's the one next to her? I wouldn't mind a tumble with her after the raid."
"That's Bethany. I think she's paired with one of the McConnors. And anyway, what about Samantha? It's only another month until she's due, right?"
"So? This is why I love being a McFoster. We exist to kill the Starflyer and breed enough warriors to make the cause successful. That's our duty. We fight, we fuck. When you think about it, what else is there worth doing? And believe me, that's Bethany over there. She'll be thinking along the same lines."
"Dear dreaming heavens, Bruce, she'll be thinking how to brain you with her pistol butt, that's all. Can't you ever get a grip on yourself?" Casimir unfolded the lightweight shield coat and threw it over Kraken's back, bracing himself should the beast not want it and react with a fast kick. The dark fabric was embroidered with glittering black metal curls and spirals. Long tassels hung from the lower edges, almost touching the ground. He started to smooth it over the warhorse's thick skin, and used its straps to tie it to the bolt rings.
"I'm being honest," Bruce protested with genuine hurt feelings. "You know that.
This raid is going to make every female fighter incredibly horny afterward. It does me.
What better way to celebrate our glorious victory?"
"How about in a civilized fashion?"
"Ha! I remember the West Irrel raid. You were drunk for a week after, and you vanished off with that McSobel. What was her name?
Lena. He didn't mention it was because in the midst of his happy drunken haze, Lena had looked more than a little like Justine.
That's the one. So don't go all noble on me. You and I are the same.
Bruce's arm went around his friend's shoulder. He turned the reluctant Casimir until they were both facing the young McNoack women and gave them a cheery wave. Andrea returned a sly smile, her gaze lingering on Casimir before turning to her Charlemagne. Her three companions went into a huddle with her. The boys heard giggling.
Now tell me that wasn't an invitation, Bruce insisted. Look at her. What a figure. I bet she'll be as lusty as hell in bed. And those breasts, dear heaven, they're huge.
Will you shut up? Casimir tried to clamp his hand over Bruce's mouth.
They'll hear you.
You're such a virgin.
Ooh, be quiet or they'll hear how much we like them.
Wake up and smell the coffee, Kaz. You're not going to live forever, and it's such a beautiful life in the meantime, especially when it's got breasts that size in it.
Stop it. He started plucking at Bruce's shirt, peering under the collar, checking the cuffs.
What are you doing, Kaz?
Looking for the off switch. Please, heaven, let there be one. Bruce laughed, pushing his friend away.
No man can stop thinking about women, especially not at a time like this. Battle fires up all the primitive instincts.
That explains a lot. Nobody gets more primitive than you.
Let's get over there. We're wasting time.
He took a step forward.
No!
Kaz almost had to lunge to grab hold of Bruce's shoulder and stop him. All four McNoack women were staring at their antics now. I swear I'll shoot you dead on the spot if you make a scene with them, he growled at Bruce. Bruce allowed himself to be halted in mid-stride.
Kaz, you do care about Andrea.
I don't want the whole raiding party to think we're a pair of jerks, that's all. Which is what they will do if we go over there and you spin them your usual bullshit lines. Now will you quit being such an ass in public?
Okay, I will be quiet if you promise you'll bed her after the raid. Deal?
And that's really a promise I can make. Casimir wished his traitor mouth wasn't trying so hard to smile. It seemed as though from the moment he and Bruce became teenagers, every second of their time together had been spent plotting strategies to meet and impress the opposite sex. Now, when relationships were more adult, casual, and easier, he wasn't interested. Though Andrea was genuinely attractive, and it had been pleasant talking to her earlier, and it had been a very long time since Lena. I wonder if Justine has found a lover. She would never lack for young men pursuing her.
If you don't, I'll take her.
Casimir grunted in utter contempt. Oh, yes, and that's even closer to reality.
Everyone knows your reputation, and if she didn't know about Samantha, I'd tell her. I'll go over there and...
You'll do it, then.
Bruce's face was radiating delight.
Anything to shut you up.
Bruce hugged him heartily.
Thank the dreaming heavens. You have no idea how badly you need to get laid. Every second since your off-world nympho left has been torture for your friends.
Good. So now you know what my life is like having to listen to you the whole time.
Casimir lifted up his saddle and slung it over Kraken's back, settling it on top of the blanket. He was convinced that even the warhorse was laughing at him. The raiding party left Rock D an hour after nightfall, fully 80 clan fighters filtering out of hidden clefts amid the desert-side foothills of St. Omer. They led their warhorses at first, negotiating the tricky passes and steep dune banks. Before midnight, they had all reached the southern side of the mountain and mounted up to start their descent into the lowlands. Small tufts of wiry, dry grass, the color of straw, were appearing in the gritty sand. As the gentle folds in the land began to deepen into distinct valleys, the grass turned greener and began to spread out into patches that soon joined together into a single carpet. This far down, and facing due east, a cold wind blew at them. For the first time they felt a tinge of moisture against exposed skin. The air warmed quickly as they moved steadily lower. Even though it was now deepest night, they were only a few degrees south of the equator. A thin belt of giant heather formed the upper border to the forest that covered the lower half of St. Omer's eastern slopes. By daybreak, they were safely under cover of the lush trees and moving in small groups among the myriad hidden tracks. They had a long break at midday, taking time to sleep as best they could as the heavy warm rain pattered against the broad canopy of leaves overhead. A quick cold meal at the start of the afternoon, and they were on their way again. As the light began to drain out of the sapphire sky, they had reached the edge of the forest, where the land fell away in a steep shingle and grass ridge. The captains of every squad sent out scouts, who crept up to the edge of the ridge to check the ambush point. Several of them were McSobles, who pinpointed and neutralized the remote sensors that the Institute had installed along the road below. Far Away only had one major road, Highway 1, which ran southward from Armstrong City to cross the equator, where it snaked along the western side of the Great Iril Steppes, until finally driving into the valley where the Marie Celeste had crash-landed and the Institute had been built to study it. The road provided the sole supply route from the gateway in the city to the Institute, a twin-lane strip of enzyme-bonded concrete, extruded by the only pair of tracked road builders ever to be exported to Far Away. They'd been brought in specifically for that one job, although once they'd finished the long north-south route, they'd managed to keep going long enough to lay down a few smaller roads linking Armstrong City with the larger towns in the north. But after they finally broke down, no spare parts were ever brought in to fix them. From their position atop the ridge, the clan scouts could see the stone-gray ribbon of the road curving around the hill that marked the entrance to the alien Ark ship's valley. It was late afternoon, and the thick cover of vegetation that lay across the lowland was still streaming gently. Carried on the air, echoing and drifting out of the valley that contained the Institute, was the faintest of mechanical sounds. For over a year now, scouts had been reporting increased activity around the massive metal hull. The news had been given an ominous reception by the clans. Its synchronicity with the work on the human starship was too strong to be ignored. But now, from the vantage point of the ridge, there was no sign of any activity. Nobody was using the road. The scouts settled down and waited. Their information on the convoy was good. It was only a matter of time. Every couple of weeks, a supply convoy delivered food and equipment to the Institute. It took at least a week to drive the route down from the city, often longer depending on the road's state of repair and the level of sabotage by the Guardians. Each convoy was protected by soldiers who were hired by the Institute and licensed by the Planetary Governor. The Guardians had been monitoring this convoy since it left Armstrong City. There were 20 big trucks hauling the cylindrical freight containers that had arrived through the gateway over the last fortnight. They were all Ford Saab VF-44s, 16-wheel, twin-axle, diesel-fueled, and manual drive. Even the most sophisticated arrays would have trouble coping with Far Away's poor surfaces and absence of satellite positioning systems. The Institute had chosen them for its transport fleet because they were designed for low maintenance and rough terrain. Driving with them were 8 matte black Land Rover cruisers, vehicles in common use among Commonwealth police and paramilitary forces operating in remote areas. On the road, they rode low on 6 independent suspension wheels, which could extend down and out to carry them over really rugged ground. The rest of the convoy was made up by a huge fuel tanker and a couple of tow repair trucks. When they reached the last stretch of road before the start of the Institute Valley, it was already twilight. The scouts saw the headlights blazing ahead of them, visible for kilometers across the rumpled countryside, advertising their presence. A couple of the cruisers were out in front, their drivers accelerating eagerly. Now they could see the sodium-orange corona from the Institute's little town crowning the hill ahead. The dark sky was ripped apart by 3 blinding streets of plasma as the McSobles opened fire from the top of the ridge. 2 of the bolts struck the lead truck, blasting it apart. Inertia kept the disintegrating bulk tumbling forward as the freight containers spewed out great streamers of flame. After a couple of seconds, the flaming wreckage flipped over and skidded to a stop, blocking the road. The 3rd plasma bolt hit the fuel tanker. A tremendous explosion bloomed out, the fireball eruption swelling in seconds until it was over 30 meters wide, lighting up the whole convoy with garish menace. The trucks directly ahead and behind were completely engulfed, their own subsequent detonation adding to the devastation. Every vehicle in the convoy emergency braked as the attack began, wheels locking and screeching as they scored huge scars of black rubber along the enzyme-bonded concrete. Several of them came dangerously close to fishtailing as their automatic systems fought to stabilize the braking sequence. Another three plasma bolts flashed down. Two of them found their targets, smashing trucks apart in swarms of flaming debris. But the driver of the third truck had reflexes fast enough to activate his force field as he struggled to halt the bucking vehicle. A hemispherical shell of air solidified around the truck, sizzling electric blue as the bolt hit. Spikes of lightning lashed off in every direction. Long, jagged lines of concrete ruptured into gravel and soot as the energy discharge pounded the road. Slim streamers of lava welled up in the gashes. There was nothing the force field could do to protect the truck from them as it slithered onward. Tires burst apart as they touched the molten rock, tipping the wheel hubs onto the ground. The front edge of the cab gouged out a huge scar as it shuddered to a violent stop. By then, every other surviving vehicle had a force field surrounding it. Drivers shouted into their radios for help and instructions, receiving nothing but thick static, even on the encrypted security channels. The road was completely blocked. If they were going to get to the safety of the valley, they would have to drive across open ground. Force fields made progress along a flat surface difficult. To travel over such rugged terrain, the strength of the protective hemispheres would also have to be reduced. Nobody wanted to do that. A further series of plasma bolts whipped down, hammering at the force fields like the spears of angry gods. None of them penetrated, but the pyrotechnic electron display was lighting up the countryside for kilometers around. Waiting in their cabs, engines running, praying for reinforcements, the drivers watched in horror as the strobing incandescence revealed a dark horde of horsemen rushing down the ridge toward the road. Casimir had fitted active lenses into his eyes long before the scouts reported the convoy was approaching. The view they presented him gave the world a pale emerald tint, but it stayed sharp and clear as the sun went down. Along with the rest of the Charlemagnes, he hung back from the top of the ridge so the enemy had no hint of their presence. Then the McSobles fired the plasma cannon. His lenses simply refused to let that much light through into his eyes. He saw them as pink lines blinking on and off, like an afterimage of the noon sun traced across his retina. That was the signal to advance. With the sound of the exploding trucks reverberating around him, he urged Kraken forward to the crest of the ridge. A quick sideways glance showed Bruce at his side, laughing like a demon as the massive warhorses picked up speed. Then they were over the ridge, and the entire panorama glared brilliant jade below them as the diminishing tanker truck fireball ascended into the sky. He watched the trucks skidding about on the road, their force fields haloed by pieces of flaming wreckage that bounced and skittered across the invisible screens. The cruisers had all turned off the road and were driving straight toward the clan raiders as they charged down the slope. As the distance quickly shrank, the raiders started to fire their ion pistols and the larger carbines. Force fields protecting the cruisers flared chrome yellow, but none of the shots got through. The thunder of hooves was now as loud as the howl of flames bursting out of the ruined tanker and the crackling energy weapons. Kinetic rapid-fire guns on the front of the cruisers opened up. Tall gouts of earth sprayed up around Kraken. One of the projectiles struck Casimir. His force field rang like a sepulchral church bell, completely deafening him. Vibrant slivers of energy rippled down the dark, confining field, then surged through the curlicues embroidered in the warhorse's shield blanket, turning the metal a glimmering white before grounding out through the bottom of the tassels. Blue and purple sparks fizzed out around Kraken's hooves as they charged onward. The air was filled with the sharp tang of burning metal. All around him, the clan raiders were trailing fabulous streamers of St. Elmo's fire as the projectiles hammered into them, human comets streaking across the gloom. Warhorses screamed as the gunfire tore their flesh open, falling to the earth as blood poured through huge, tattered wounds. A flight of missiles soared overhead. The cruiser guns switched their aim upward, trying to lock on to the elusive barrage. Soldiers jumped out of the rear of the vehicles, sprinting for cover. They started firing ion rifles at the raiders. Their armor suit force fields became vivid coronal beacons as they were shot at in turn. The front line of war horses wavered as their casualties built up. They were almost level with the lumbering cruisers now. Small groups peeled away. Casimir urged Kraken toward the front end of the convoy. There was little thought involved. He simply remembered that was where he was supposed to go. 5 times he'd been hit by kinetic bullets or ion rifle fire. So far his armor suit's force field had held. Terror and exhilaration surged through his body, crushing almost all rational thought. Only some faint recollection of the plan kept him moving in the right direction. He loved the vivacity of the mad ride straight into the lethal muzzles of the Institute soldiers. Simultaneously, the constant fear of being cut to shreds any second made him scream wordless defiance at his foes while shooting his ion pistol wildly. It was insanity and utterly beautiful. Even Kraken seemed to share the recklessness, pounding on into the heart of the bedlam. Blood from 2 craterous wounds was running down the war horse's flanks, soaking the shield blanket. Bruce was still level with him, still wearing the same rictus grin that had begun on the top of the ridge. He yelled something that Casimir never heard above the clamor. Then he was gesturing urgently with the long barrel of his ion carbine. Casimir glanced ahead. The road was only 50 meters away now, as brilliantly lit as any city, showing a zigzag jam of trucks. Bruce gestured again at the second truck, which had come to rest with its force field just nudging into the sputtering flames of the ruined lead truck. Casimir's heated zeal subsided enough for him to nod sharp agreement, and they both altered track for the trapped vehicle. Kraken galloped over the road in front of the flames, with Casimir pulling on the reins to slow their unruly flight and curve back to the second truck. It was at that moment he saw into the Institute Valley for the first time in his life. He couldn't see far down it. The angle was wrong for that. From his position, all he could make out were a few nondescript low buildings clustered around the end of Highway 1. Beyond them, however, the aft section of the alien arc ship was just visible. Casimir had always known its dimensions, and how only something that large could survive centuries of travel between the stars. But all the statistics Harvey had coached him in had never registered the way seeing it for real did. The diabolical thing was big. Its fuselage design followed a simple cylindrical geometry, with various protrusions and fins breaking the uniformity of its 800-meter length, and a complex wart cluster of force field generators at the prow. At the rear, it was a sheer circular cliff of metal, 250 meters in diameter, with the 8 stubby nozzles of its fusion drives sticking out. The Institute had set up a ring of powerful arc lights around the ship, centering it in a huge pool of bright monochrome light. Not that Casimir could see many of the slate-gray metal hull plates. Vast arches of scaffolding had been erected around the Marie Celeste, supporting access walkways running the length of the fuselage. The shapes of humans and bots were discernible, moving along the aluminum planking, tiny scavenger insects swarming over some fallen corpse. Cranes rose from the apex of the scaffolding, their long gantries hauling up big freight containers to the loading bays on every walkway level. Flashes of ruby laser light were coming from the dark cavities of the fusion drive nozzle, evidence of a great deal of activity within. A sudden chill washed over Casimir's skin, sobering his thoughts. Actually seeing the enemy that his clan was sworn to destroy was a humbling experience. The power and purpose reflected in the massive arc ship was formidable, an extension of its master's will. He felt pathetically small by comparison.
"Come on!" Bruce yelled as he galloped past. "For fuck's sake, Kaz!"
Casimir dropped his gaze from the ship and saw a fleet of black Land Rover cruisers tearing out of the Institute town, accelerating toward them. He grunted, "Oh, shit!" under his breath, and urged Kraken around toward the intact truck. His hand fumbled with the equipment belt hanging from the side of his saddle, but he eventually found the dump web unit and pulled it free. 10 meters ahead of him, Bruce was holding his own dump web, leaning forward in his saddle as he rushed up to the force field surrounding the truck. His arm began to sway to and fro, calculating the weight and closing distance. Then, as the warhorse was only a meter from the edge of the force field, He swung the unit in a short arc and let go. The damp web hit the ground and bobbled along until it reached the shield. Casimir had little chance to check his friend's accuracy. He was doing the same thing with his own unit, letting it swing slightly, watching the force field as he hurtled toward it. Speed, distance, angle. He judged them all and dropped it at what he knew was the right moment, squeezing the activation trigger as it left his hand. The heavy gadget bounced a couple of times, then slapped into the force field. Internal sensors detected the coherent energy structure and immediately deployed the compressed nest of conductive filaments at the core of the unit. Fine dark strands expanded quickly, sliding their way along the curve of the shield like a stain spreading upward. The flimsy mesh began to leach energy out of the force field, channeling the flow down into the ground. Smoke began to rise up from the enzyme-bonded concrete where the lower half of the web was unfurling. On the back of the truck, behind the cab, the force field generator began a near-subliminal whining as it consumed more and more power, trying to reinforce the relentless drain that was gnawing into it in two places. The driver watched helplessly as more and more indicators on the cab dashboard turned from amber to red. 30 seconds after Casimir let go of his dump web, the huge quantity of energy that the generator had to pull from its superconductor battery to maintain the shield's integrity exceeded its rated wattage. The force field collapsed, as small turquoise flames jetted out of glowing cherry-red cooling fins on the generator casing. Several hundred meters overhead, Loiter missiles, launched by the McSobels, detected the failure. Their sensors acquired the naked truck. Solid rocket boosters ignited, and they screamed down vertically at Mach 4. Casimir was halfway back to the bottom of the ridge when the truck exploded behind him. He risked a quick look over his shoulder and whooped for joy at the sight of the billowing flames. There must have been some volatiles in one of the containers. Flaming aquamarine globules were spinning out of the main explosion, soaring across the night sky like rampant fireworks. Another convoy truck's force field vanished, and long rocket plumes blazed high above as missiles locked on. Several clan raiders were circling the remaining trucks, ready to throw their dump webs. Spread out between the road and the ridge, the firefight between Institute soldiers and the remaining mounted raiders was intense. The rapid-fire guns on the cruisers were inflicting heavy casualties among the Charlemagnes. Retaliatory ion carbine shots were directed at the vehicles, turning their protective force fields into seething bubbles of light. Casimir tugged the reins slightly, steering Kraken away from the stationary cruisers. According to the plan, all he had to do now was get back to the top of the ridge, and from there the rendezvous point. At that moment he hadn't realized how close the Institute reinforcements had come until the rapid-fire guns on the first of the new Land Rovers opened fire. A patch of ground along the side of Kraken tore open, throwing up a ragged curtain of earth and vegetation. The big beast bellowed in shock, jerking sharply to one side. Casimir clung on grimly. Bruce was slightly ahead of him, staying low in the saddle. 10 meters beyond him, three Institute soldiers jumped up from nowhere and opened fire with their ion rifles. Bruce's force field glared like a fragment of captured sunlight, the howl of its energy stresses louder than any thunderclap. Perilously thick tendrils of electricity writhed across his Charlemagne's shield blanket, punching out of the tassels like a jet exhaust. Casimir was already shooting back at the soldiers, forcing them to stop, when Bruce's warhorse reared up as if to charge its attackers. Kinetic projectiles from a cruiser rapid-fire gun plunged into its underbelly, shredding hide, organs, and bone in a cloud of crimson vapor. Time and gravity withdrew for a moment, allowing the mighty warhorse to hang poised on its hind legs. Then it slowly toppled over. Casimir howled, "No!" as he watched Bruce slide off the saddle, instinctively seeing the shape that the fall would take. Bruce hit the ground first, and ion rifle fire pummeled at him, straining his armor toward overload. The warhorse collapsed on top of him, its momentum rolling it over. Casimir froze, staring in agony as more and more of his friend was engulfed by the massive carcass. Bruce actually managed to lift one arm, as if he were clawing his way free. Then the force field nimbus flickered and died. The warhorse completed its role, crushing the human beneath an avalanche of dead, steaming flesh. More trucks exploded as missiles slammed down. The newly arrived Land Rovers rushed onward, driving straight for the retreating groups of war horses. Clan raiders concentrated their fire on individual Institute soldiers, overwhelming their armor. Kraken stood perfectly still as the battle raged around them. Casimir hadn't moved, his stare fixed on the bloody remains of Bruce's warhorse, unaware of anything else. Waiting. Waiting. Another clan raider charged past, screaming something at Casimir, half of it obscenities. Sound and light swooped back into Casimir's universe. The raid was over. They were supposed to be leaving. Already, most of the war horses were galloping back up the slope. He spurred Kraken on, searching the ground ahead. A couple of the Institute soldiers were kneeling beside a clump of thick bushes not 20 meters away, shooting at the raiders on the slope above. Casimir was never sure if it was him or Kraken who chose the direction, only that it was the right direction. They were suddenly moving toward the soldiers, picking up speed. The soldiers had a few seconds' warning, both of them turning to gape in consternation at the terrible medieval vision of vengeance bearing down on them. One ran, one brought his rifle up. Kraken lowered its head, the titanium blade of its horn level with the soldier's chest. Casimir's face was contorted into a vicious sneer of triumph as the tip rammed home into the soldier's force field. There was a brief cascade of sparks, streaming out of his torso like some ephemeral flower. Then the carbon-bonded blade punctured the armor, slicing clean through the sternum and into the soft tissue of the organs inside the ribcage. That was when Kraken shoved its neck back, ripping the blade upward. The soldier's body left the ground, dragged upward as the blade continued its scythe through his upper half before it pulled out with a last violent shake as Kraken twisted. The torn figure spun lazily through the air, squirting arterial blood as it went. Casimir knew he should have felt joy, the sweetness of revenge. But it was a hollow, meaningless victory. It mattered nothing to Bruce that the soldier was dead. He wouldn't care, wouldn't rejoice back in West D, wouldn't down glass after glass of beer, would never get his chance with Bethany. Bruce was dead. As if knowing Casimir's confusion, Kraken sped away back up the slope on its own accord, carrying its rider back to the safety of the forest. The rendezvous spot was a patch of clear ground alongside a small stream deep in the forest. There should have been 12 McFosters gathered there. Instead, there were only 9. A somber Scott McFoster began the roll call. Casimir listened to the names with eyes closed and tears leaking down his cheeks. The roll call was the formal end of every raid. Unless you were there and confirmed your name to the squad leader, there could be no readmission to the clan and its places, the villages, farms, and forts. Too many fighters had fallen in battle only to be caught and enslaved by the Starflyer. Many of them were sent back to infiltrate and kill the very clansmen and women they had grown up among. The roll call prevented such treachery from reoccurring. Bruce McFoster? The way Scott said it told everyone he already knew. Casimir opened his mouth. He was going to shout, "Yes, I'm here. I made it back." But all he could see behind closed eyelids was the last sliver of radiance from Bruce's force field going out. The half-second glimpse of fright rushing across Bruce's face as he realized. Then there was just a mass of blood and gore descending, the sickening crunch of bone snapping. "Bruce McFoster, your name will be written in honor on our clan's memorial for those who have forever escaped the Starflyer's reach. We pray that your final sleep will be filled with dreams of a better place." "Amen," the others murmured. "Casimir McFoster?" The faint second skin of light extinguished. How long would it have taken Bruce to die as his body was pulped? Who was going to tell Samantha? "Kaz," someone urged. "Here," he said brokenly. "I'm here." Which was such a blatant lie. He wasn't himself, not anymore. A part was missing. It was never coming back. The Manby Memorial Clinic was in Little Sussex, one of the more pleasant residential districts of New Costa. Senior management had their big homes and sweeping gardens here, protectively moated by middle management developments. The shops were small and exclusive, the schools high class, and the facilities generally excellent. There wasn't a factory within 25 kilometers. The AEC police car swept up to the center's main entrance, and its door opened for Paula. She got out and greeted Elaine Castle, the clinic's deputy manager. As the woman chatted away in a slightly nervous manner, Paula underwent a touch of déjà vu. It wasn't that long ago she'd visited the Claydon Clinic and Wyobi Kotal. But then most of her cases involved a visit to medical facilities at some point or other. Elaine took her past the first two blocks, which contained the private recovery rooms, day lounges, and physical therapy spas. Paula was familiar with the setup. Her own post-rejuvenation rehabilitations had been spent in almost identical buildings. The Manby had a slightly plusher decor, but the rituals would be the same. Elaine Castle was delivering her to the third block, where the actual rejuvenation treatment was conducted. The long corridors were strangely empty. As Paula passed a lounge, she saw a number of recovering clients slumped in deep chairs watching the Augusta St. Lincoln Cup match. Nursing staff hung around unobtrusively, keeping an eye on the big portal as the two national teams duked it out on emerald grass. "I'm afraid you will have to wait for another couple of hours," the deputy manager said apologetically, as a collective groan went up from the lounge, as St. Lincoln's striker missed a shot. "Professor Bowes was withdrawn from the actual treatment chamber only 40 minutes ago. It will take him a while to recover sufficiently to answer your questions." "I can wait that long," Paula said. On any other world, it would have taken weeks just to get a court order allowing her to interrupt a rejuvenation. But CST was paying for Bose's fast-tracked treatment, and Augusta was essentially controlled by the Sheldon family. It hadn't been difficult to arrange. Paula was shown into a reception room, where a man and a woman were standing waiting. "This is Mrs. Wendy Bose," Elaine said. "And..." "Professor Troughton," the man said, offering his hand. He was in late middle age, dressed in the kind of suit that Paula guessed had gone out of fashion several centuries earlier. The fabric was a brown tweed, cut with very small lapels. Judging from the tightness across his shoulders, the professor must have bought it quite some time ago. "I've wanted to meet you for some time, Chief Investigator," he said. "It's a shame it had to be under these circumstances." "What circumstances?" Paula asked. "You exert a natural fascination on members of my profession. Unfortunately, I am here to represent Professor and Mrs. Bowes."
Paula gave Wendy Bowes a sharp glance. In her opinion, the woman's jittery inability to return the contact spelled out a great deal of guilt. Unfortunately, Paula didn't know what the crime could possibly be. The directorate had run its usual search, and Wendy Bowes had come up completely clean.
"And what is your little profession exactly?"
"Ah, yes, I teach law at Leonida City University."
Paula kept staring at Wendy Bowes, who was looking all around the small room. "I didn't know the professor was guilty of anything."
"He's not. Everybody is innocent until proven guilty. Commonwealth Charter Clause 3A, as I'm sure you're aware."
"If he's not guilty, what does he need a lawyer for?"
"I don't know. What do you want to question him about?"
Elaine cleared her throat.
"I think I'll leave at this point."
"Thank you," Paula said. "Please call me when Professor Bowes has recovered."
"Of course. So does a professor of law on Growlmond know much about Augusta law?"
Paula asked, once the door had closed behind the deputy manager.
"There's not much law here to know. Augusta is hardly an enviable democratic model."
"Exactly. You don't have any jurisdiction here.
Whereas I have a lot. I can have you removed from the planet very easily."
"Surely you believe in fairness, Chief Investigator."
"Fairness I believe in more than you ever can. I also believe in justice. What I don't tolerate is lawyers interfering with that justice."
"Ah, yes, we're always the bad guys, aren't we?
Wherever you find human misery, you find lawyers, either causing it or making a profit from it."
"Please,"
Wendy Bowes implored.
"I asked
Professor Trutton to come here? I don't know any lawyers on Augusta, and we don't have much money. Dudley isn't receiving any salary while he's in regeneration.
Dudley is a colleague, Trudon said. Surely having a witness and advisor can't harm your investigation. He's bound to ask for a lawyer anyway.
I'm not investigating Dudley Bowes, Paula said. As far as I know, he's not guilty of anything.
She gave the lawyer a pointed look. You obviously believe differently.
Why is that?
Wendy Bowes gave Trutton a questioning look.
I don't understand, the lawyer said. Dudley is only having 2 months of rejuvenation treatment.
That's all the time he can afford before the starship leaves, and that'll barely get him into a reasonable physical condition. This investigation must be incredibly important for you to have to pull him out of that. You might have cost him his place on the crew.
Not a factor for me. What do you think he's done?
Wendy Bowes asked.
There was desperation in her voice, but Paula knew that wasn't all. Some of the worry was for herself.
Very well, but this investigation is confidential. You are not at liberty to discuss it without my express permission.
I am aware of basic law.
Trutton trailed off under Paula's gaze.
We believe that the attack on the Second Chance was made by a group called the Guardians of Selfhood. They are an obscure paramilitary political group based on Far Away, who believe the Commonwealth is politically manipulated by an alien.
I've heard of them, Trudon said. My e-butler has let their shotgun messages through its filter several times, unfortunately.
In order for them to see the Second Chance as a threat, Paula said, they would need to establish a link between its construction and their alleged enemy alien. What I'm trying to do is uncover that link, or at least their belief in a link.
As the whole mission started because of Professor Bowes's discovery, he was the logical place to begin.
I hardly think this warrants yanking him out of the treatment.
It didn't, Paula said. This kind of data analysis is a standard correlation for the Directorate RI. It came up with an unusual coincidence. I want to ask the professor about it.
That's all.
What was the coincidence?
The Cox Education Charity account in the Denman Manhattan Bank was subject to an attempted data hack some while ago, prior to the attack. The charity is one of the sponsors of your husband's astronomy department. Obviously, the Guardians believed the charity was channeling money into the Dyson Pear Observation Project on behalf of the alien. We assume they were trying to find their evidence for this in the charity's financial records. They weren't successful in gaining access to the secure files. The bank's smartware managed to lock them out. It wasn't considered important at the time. The bank is subject to many such attacks. But the Trojan the hackers used to ride in on was based around Professor Bowes's codes. She watched with interest as the color faded from Wendy Bowes's face. The woman reached out for Trutton's support.
Is there something you'd like to tell me?
Trutton nodded encouragingly. His grip on Wendy Bowes's arm tightened.
There could have been a degree of affection in that grip, Paula decided.
He said to tell you something, Wendy Bowes said. I didn't understand at the time.
Your husband?
No, the reporter. He said, tell her from me to stop concentrating on the details. It's the big picture that counts.
A reporter said that to you?
Yes, to tell Paula when I see her, that's what he said. I don't know anyone called Paula, and we were talking about the astronomy department's sponsors. He was interviewing me.
When was this?
Months ago. I think it was when my husband was awarded his professorship. There was a party afterward, a lot of people. Most of the media wanted to talk to us.
This reporter mentioned me by name.
Me?
Yes, definitely.
What was his name?
I think it was Brad.
Bradley, Paula mouthed. Surprise chilled her skin.
For the first time ever, she knew how it must feel to come off worse during an interview, to have your confidence kicked out from under you.
You know the gentleman? Trutton asked mildly.
Paula ignored his gentle mockery. I'll need a description of this Brad person. Were there any other reporters recording the party?
Probably, yes. There's something else.
What?
We left the party early. There had been some kind of break-in at the house. Whoever did it copied all the memories in our household array. She brightened. That would hold Dudley's information about the Cox Educational Charity Bank account, wouldn't it?
Yes, Paula said softly.
So Dudley's innocent then, isn't he? He can go on the starship.
I'm not going to stop him. She didn't comment on the way the loyal wife and the supportive colleague hugged each other.
Ozzy was rocked from side to side as the big awkward sled jostled along over the frozen surface of the depression. The murky interior of the covered sled was actually colder than the inside of the tent, despite an iron brazier filled with glowing, hissing charcoal. Even so, Ozzy felt a lot more comfortable now they were underway. Orion also perked up considerably as the ride progressed, sitting on the long bench, his sleeping bag wrapped around him like a quilt. The sled framework was constructed mainly out of bone, great honey brown ribs of it, cut and fitted together as if they were lengths of wood. Walls and ceiling, and the benches they were sitting on, were made from stiff black leather, which Ozzy could see had been poorly scraped. A strip of clear crystal in the front wall, which he presumed was a chunk from the local trees, provided the only window. It gave him a rough view out across the ice-locked ground, but mainly of the swaying rumps of the two big Ibnan that were pulling them. Bill, the big Korok Hai, was standing on an open platform at the rear, steering them with a long set of reins. He was keeping their speed low so that the Lontrus could keep up.
"What is this ice citadel place?" Ozzy asked. "I'm not sure what it was originally," Sarah said.
Now they were inside. Her face mask hung on straps at the side of her hood. The brazier's somber light had turned her creased skin as dark as Ozzy's.
"Most of us think it was some kind of Sylphen lodge. They still use it when they come to hunt the ice whales."
She patted her fur coat.
"That's where all this comes from. I'll need a new one soon. I've had this 7 years now." "It wears well if you take care of it."
Ozzy glanced around the sled again. "And the bone?"
"Smart lad. Yes. In that respect, they're like the whales on old Earth. A valuable resource. We can use them for a lot of things. Once the Sylphen have killed them and taken their trophy tusks, they don't mind us utilizing the rest of it. A hunt is quite a sight. The Sylphen ride out like some royal medieval pageant dressed up in all their winter finery. Then you get Aslot hanging on behind, trying to keep up. After they kill an ice whale, we set up camp for a week to butcher and cook the damn thing. Most parts have a use here. Even the blood has a kind of alcohol in it to stop it freezing. Not that you can drink it. And there's been enough experimental stills over the years. Then there's one gland in the male ice whale which some people dry and then grind up. They say the powder puts the peck in your pecker, if you know what I mean.
I think I get the idea.
Some of the organs have medicinal properties, so our doctor claims. Not just for us, but other species at the ice citadel. And of course, the meat is edible. That's our basic diet.
She puckered her lips in disapproval, deepening the mass of wrinkles on her cheeks and forehead.
You have no idea how truly boring ice whale meat can get. Were you two riding horses?
Up until, like, 2 days ago, yes.
Horse steak. Now there's a gourmet dish. If folks hear there are some horse bodies lying around out there for the taking, they might just put themselves in gear and get an expedition together. 2 days away, you say?
Roughly, yeah. Not that we walk very fast.
Ozzy had eaten horse before, so the thought didn't make him too squeamish, but he could see the boy turn his nose up in disgust.
That's near the limit, Sarah said. It would be a risk. But there's some who'll take it just for the chance of tasting something different.
What sort of risk? You seem well equipped for this planet.
It's not equipment, lad, it's location. The Sylphen paths aren't stable, you know. Once you start going deep into the forests, there's no telling where you might wind up.
You mean like there's no dependable way to get out of here?
There's a million ways out, by all accounts. And then again, there's another million ways to stay. I've seen them sometimes, with my own eyes. Friends who can't take the ice citadel anymore. They set off into the forest, looking for somewhere better. Years go by and you think they must have made it. Must be safe.
Then an expedition will come across their bodies, all stiff and black.
Orion pulled the sleeping bag tighter around him, fighting the way his chin was quivering. Ozzy gave the woman a look, but she didn't seem perturbed. If there's a way in, there's a way out, he said.
Sure there is. What I'm telling you is nobody here knows one. Anybody who does leave permanently doesn't come back. At least I've never seen one return. How long have you been here?
Orion asked.
I'm not sure. Some of the places I've visited might not have had the same kind of time as others. They were different. Don't ask me how. You only realize once you've left. When you try and remember, every moment you spent there was like a dream.
Then there's the paths. Time flows along them as well. You probably realize that the climates merge very gently. To do that, they have to match seasons.
But how long?
Orion persisted. The old woman smiled, showing copper-colored teeth.
Put it this way. I walked off Earth in 2009.
Orion let out a gasp of surprise.
No way!
Oh, yes. I was on vacation in Tuscany. I still liked doing that, walking through the countryside, visiting the towns, sampling the food. There were enough areas of it that the developers never got around to ruining, which made it worthwhile. One day I packed my backpack and hiked off into the forest. That was it. I've been out here ever since. I never really wanted to go back. I mean, what's the point?
Interesting. Ozzy said. It was fascinating to know the Sylphan paths had led to Earth in those days, but somehow not surprising.
That would make you about 400 years old. They didn't have rejuvenation on Earth back then, not even in Europe.
I've never been rejuvenated. I told you. Time runs differently along the paths.
But you just said you don't walk the paths anymore.
I'm here, though, and I encounter the Sylphan most years.
She shrugged.
This isn't something you rationalize and order, Ozzy. Everything that is here simply happens. Don't try to assign reason to what you experience.
Right.
Please, Orion said. Do you know if my mom and dad are here? What are their names? Morris and Catania. Oh, I'm sorry, Orion. There's nobody here with those names. And I can't recall a couple passing through either.
The boy hung his head.
Not every path from Silver Galda leads here, you know, she said. They could be anywhere. Some nice tropical island, perhaps. Yeah, whatever.
She looked at Ozzy, who gave her a don't ask me shrug. The ice citadel gradually grew larger in front of them. It was difficult for Ozzy to see clearly through the grubby ice-crusted crystal window, but the basic pyramid shape soon became apparent. From base to tip, it was about 70 yards high. Every surface had been covered in crystal, great lengths of the quartz trees arranged into hexagonal arrays. They were packed together in a perfect honeycomb, giving no clue as to what material was underneath. A smooth, cylindrical pillar of crystal rose from the center of each hexagon, topped by a large, multifaceted stone that swelled out almost organically. Ozzy frowned at the assembly, trying to understand its purpose. The long segments that made up the hexagons were angled in series against each other, forming tiers. Little prismatic sparkles of light danced off the sheer surfaces. They were like mirrors, he muttered to himself. Very crude concave mirrors, focusing sunlight on the central stalk. Or maybe not so crude, he decided. It would take a real artisan to get the angles just right. The top of the pyramid was a small rounded pinnacle. As he watched, the beam of green light shone out of it, sweeping around.
You can see it right over the other side of the crater, Sarah said. There's been many a night it's guided me home.
It works at night, Ozzy said.
I assumed the mirror array gathered sunlight for it.
Worked that out, huh?
Shouldn't surprise me, a techie like you. The mirrors mostly scoop up light for the rooms inside, but yeah. The top row is exclusively for the lighthouse system. They pour sunlight into some kind of light battery. Please don't ask me how it works. It looks like a big ball of stone to me.
There's always some idiot science type wanting to take it apart. We don't let them, of course.
Don't worry, I'll spare you that.
Good. We have been known to run some people out of town. And as far as we know, there isn't another town on the whole damn planet.
The sled came slowly to a halt at the base of the pyramid. Ozzy and Orion pulled their gloves on again, covered their faces, and stepped out carrying their packs. Another couple of the Korokhai warbled mournfully to Bill as they started to unharness the big Ibnan that had pulled the sled. Some humans, or human-shaped, had come over, dressed in the same bulbous fur coats as Sarah wore. There were other aliens as well, a small gnomish creature with five limbs and two things like snakes with legs, all wearing coats of ice whale fur. Ozzy stopped to study them. He'd never seen their kind before. He began to wonder just how far into the galaxy the Sylphan paths ran.
This way, Sarah beckoned. Iusha will stable your lontrus for you.
There were a number of archways of various sizes along the base of the pyramid, from trapdoor height up to an opening wide enough to take two sleds at once. There was a lot of activity around them, with animals, again types he'd never seen, and aliens coming in and out. Several sleds resembling racing toboggans were being prepared. She led them through one of the archways into an antechamber with plain black marble walls. At the far end was a big revolving door made from bone, with thin crystal window panes.
It's like a heat lock, she said as she pushed one of the panels and set the doors moving.
Beyond that was a wide corridor walled with the same marble. Long panels of quartz were set into the ceiling, with pink sunlight pouring out of them. Ozzy stood underneath one and squinted into the glare. But there was nothing to see.
They light the whole place, she said. It's like a root network of big crystal ducts leading down from the mirrors on the pyramid. Same principle as our fiber optic cable, but big, much bigger. The ducts are a meter wide.
The corridor angled down slightly, then opened out into broad stairs that curved around out of sight. They started their descent. The curve was actually a wide spiral. Ozzy lost track of how many times they went around and how deep they were. It was a long way down. Sarah took her face mask off, then unbuttoned the front of her coat. She was wearing woolen trousers and a thick blue sweater underneath. Ozzy realized he was getting warmer and unzipped his own coat. What heats this place?
Hot springs, she told them. It was built right above them.
I wasn't kidding about that bath. The stairs ended at an archway. Sarah watched as they walked out onto the main floor of the ice citadel. Ozzy took a few steps in and came to a halt. He'd entered an alien cathedral, a vaulting dome at least 80 yards high. Pillars curved up the walls like some arcane ribcage, supporting 7 balcony rings. It had to be a religious monument. The alcove walls between the pillars were carved marble. Thousands of different creatures stared out at Ozzy. Every third was a sylphan. Somehow the artist had given each one a majesty surpassing the divine quality suggested for the human prophets. They'd all been captured at the same moment of revelation and veneration, seeing the wonder dwelling beyond the physical universe. The bas-relief landscapes around them ranged from arboreal scenes to stark landscapes with exotic moons in the sky, cities of grandiose buildings and even technological surroundings. Right at the apex, a mandala of crystal strips shone brighter than the sunlight outside.
Jesus wept, he exclaimed.
As proof that the Sylphan did have a tangible culture, it was a startling introduction. In the center of the floor was a large pool, fed by a raised fountain, whose waters steamed gently as it splashed and gurgled. There was no altar or rows of seating, which Ozzy was half expecting. Long tables made of bone and leather had been set up on granite paving that was worn and badly cracked. On the other side, a large rectangular stone hearth had been built, with neat brick-walled ovens on top. Flames were visible flickering through grids set in the base. Judging by the background smell in the room, and the soot clogging the oven brickwork, it was some kind of fat-based oil fuel. Several humans and aliens fussed around on tables next to the hearth, preparing a meal. The chamber obviously served as a main meeting place for the Ice Citadel residents. Even in the daytime, it was busy. The number of species astounded Ozzy. He could make out at least 12 different types. Creatures with 3 legs, 4 legs, 6 legs, some that squirmed or wriggled across the floor, one that hopped, and something that was either a young Rael or a close cousin. Big and small, they had skins in many shades, scales, fur, spines, and oil rainbow membranes. Clothes on those that bothered ranged from simple togas to practical utility harnesses. Like the statues, every creature was now focused on Ozzy and Orion. They were stared at, smelled, echo-sounded, heat-scanned. Orion edged behind Ozzy, who returned the attention levelly. "Where are they all from?" Ozzy asked. "Do we know their star systems?" "It doesn't matter where they come from," Sarah said dismissively, "only that they are here now." "Why do you want to classify them?" "That's the first step toward segregation."
"Nobody's classifying," Ozzy snapped back. "Man, this has got to be the most important gathering of cultures we know of. There are more species represented here than even the High Angel hosts. Doesn't that mean anything to you?"
"It means we have a broad fund of abilities to help us survive. I've got to find out where they come from, if they know anything more about the Sylphon."
"Introductions later," Sarah said. "Your rooms are over here."
She led them around the edge of the chamber. There was a corridor leading off between every set of pillars on the ground level. The one they walked down opened into a cluster of 3 simple circular rooms. There was crude human-style furniture in one of them, a sleeping cot and a pair of sling chairs. The leg on one chair was broken, and the leather so old and cracked, it looked like it would tear if anyone sat on it. A bathing pool took up half of the last room, filling the air with steam. Orion stuck his hand in the clear water and smiled happily at how hot it was.
"Take your time to freshen up," Sarah said. "The evening meal is served in a couple of hours. It's kind of tradition that the newest arrivals tell their stories and bring us all the news from whatever part of the galaxy they've come from."
"I can manage that," Ozzy said.
"Good."
Her expression was troubled.
"You won't try and rush off to find a path, will you? We lose a lot of people that way. At least take the time to learn the way things are around here."
"Sure, I'm not stupid. But we will be leaving as soon as we can.
Good luck."
There were 12 grand dinners, balls, and galas on the night before departure. Only one counted, of course, the one thrown by Anshun's first speaker, which was attended by Vice President Elaine Doy, Nigel Sheldon with 3 current wives from his harem, Raphael Columbia, Senator Thompson Benelli, Brewster Kumar, and 12 other notables from the Commonwealth's political ruling classes. And that, sadly, was the one which Captain Wilson Keim also had to attend. His car drove him through no less than 3 security checks, including a deep scan, on his way into the government's Regency Palace, which served as the first speaker's official residence at the heart of Treloar. The sun was just setting as he and Anna drew up outside the massive stone portico. They were greeted by 2 human servants in long frock coats covered in gold brocade. The senior one bowed deeply.
"Welcome, Captain. The first speaker is receiving her guests in the Livingston Room. Please go straight in."
"Thank you," Wilson replied.
He took Anna's hand and they walked up the big steps. She was wearing a long, formal ocean blue gown with elaborate non-symmetrical loops of gold, and a pearl necklace that seemed to merge with her glittering ock tattoos. Her hair had been cut short, ready for the voyage, but the stylist had managed to weave in some temporary extensions, flecked with platinum and phosphorescent Titian strands. He'd never seen her so elegant before. At work she was mostly in overalls or an office suit, while at the apartment she wore very little. The effect, enhanced by a thick, subtle perfume, made her extremely desirable. He wanted to rip the dress off her and have passionate sex right there on the cold tiles of the palace floor. Her pose was only slightly spoiled by the way she had to grip the front of her dress with her free hand, holding the hem off the steps as they ascended.
"Bloody classical architecture," she muttered under her breath.
As they reached the top, a shiny black Ferrari Rayon pulled up at the foot of the steps, emitting a hum of barely controlled power. A gullwing door lifted up, and Oscar climbed out.
Might have guessed, Wilson said. He was mildly envious of the car. It was a limited edition. Of course, given his age and status, he was above such things now. But he couldn't help wondering what the Ferrari would be like to drive on manual. From a purely engineering point of view, it was a superb machine. Oscar waved cheerily and dashed up the steps. He kissed Anna on the cheek. You look gorgeous tonight, my love.
Thank you, she said with a smile. You too.
Oscar carried off a tuxedo with great panache, a stylish, searing white jacket with a trendy cut, and an old-fashioned scarlet carnation in his lapel. In contrast, Wilson felt as though he'd been stuffed into his own tux, like a high school boy on a prom date. Shall we go in, boys and girls? Oscar said. They walked through the doors into the over-classical interior, dominated by gilt-framed portraits and the twisting bronze and jade shapes of first modernist sculpture. The first speaker, Gilda Princess Marden, greeted Wilson with a politician's firm, trustworthy handshake and air-kissed Anna. Wilson said something sympathetic about the planet's defeated national football team. The first speaker thanked him profusely, going into detail about the sporting and personal failings of the main striker. Well done, Anna murmured as they walked away. Only another 5 hours of small talk to go. The Livingston room's large garden doors had been folded back, allowing the guests onto the wide balcony outside. The palace courtyard's formal garden had been lit by flaming torches and yellow and green star globes hanging like fruit from the trees and larger bushes. Over 100 guests, dressed in smart, colourful clothes, suitable for the warm summer evening, were milling around as the golden sunset drained out of the horizon. Local A-list socialites mingled with famous Unisphere celebrities and wealthy grandees, while official news and political reporters maintained a respectful distance. A band was playing on a small platform set up in front of the Henry Wu Planet Sphere fountain. All three of them grabbed drinks from a waiter. Wilson could see several other crew members, each at the center of a knot of people. Like him, they were the unlucky ones. More junior members had a free choice where to spend their last night. For himself, Wilson would have preferred a less ceremonial event. I see our illustrious navigator is here, Anna said quietly at his shoulder. Wilson and Oscar saw Dudley Bowes standing beneath a Japanese maple. He'd returned from his partial rejuvenation on Augusta, having had about 15 years taken off his age. Unfortunately, his frame hadn't quite adjusted yet. Skin hung in folds from his neck. His hair was a mottled fuzz of grey and black, and a sagging belly hung over his tuxedo waistband. He was telling some story to his attentive audience of Anshun dignitaries, with his wife in close attendance, laughing as if she'd never heard the anecdote before.
Remind me again why he's coming with us, Oscar said.
Because he's the greatest expert the Commonwealth has on the Dyson pair, Anna told him demurely.
Ah, I knew there was a reason.
Wilson did his best not to frown. Not for the first time, he wished he hadn't bowed to political expediency. Bowes hadn't undergone even half of the tests that the rest of the crew had struggled their way through, let alone taken part in any meaningful training. Having the astronomer on board was simply asking for trouble. But it had got the media off his back. He saw Nigel Sheldon talking to the Vice President and other members of the Exo-Protectorate Council and made his way over to their small group. As he reached them, he realized the young-looking woman standing next to Sheldon, who had his arm around her shoulder, was Tu Li, their hyperspace officer. Her small, delicate figure was clad in a little black dress. With her raven hair cut short, she looked like a sexy imp.
Captain, Nigel grinned in welcome. I know you've met Elaine.
Wilson smiled politely at the Vice President. Farndale Engineering had chosen to donate to her rival's campaign, and Elaine Doy knew that.
Any last-minute problems? Nigel asked. No, it's all going remarkably smoothly.
We reached 0.25 light-years per hour on the last test flight, Tu Li said. That's our operational target, so we're on the green for tomorrow.
Listen to you, Nigel said.
He grinned proudly at her.
Stop it.
She gave him a sharp look.
Tu Li is my great-great-great-granddaughter, Nigel said to Wilson. Four natural-born generations. You don't get a stronger family tie than that. Can you blame me for being proud of her?
Wilson couldn't remember that being in Tu Li's file.
I hope you don't mind, Tu Li said, her dark eyes gazing intently up at Wilson.
I never said anything, because I wanted to make the crew on merit.
You succeeded, Wilson said.
He suddenly wondered why none of his own family had ever made it through the qualifying stages.
A Sheldon and a Kime, finally flying together, eh? Nigel said happily. We've got it covered from every angle.
Looks that way. Wilson was having trouble keeping his smile intact. I understand you're taking a lot of weapons on your flight, Thompson Bonelli said.
The great debate, Wilson said, not quite mocking. Do we shock culturally superior species with our primitive warlike behavior, or do we go into the unknown with sensible protection that any smart alien will understand? Given what we're facing, a degree of self-defense is appropriate, Nigel said.
Huh, Thompson snorted. What do you believe, Captain? Is the barrier a defense against some psychopathic race armed with superweapons?
We'll find out when we get there, Wilson said mildly. But I'm not taking a crew anywhere unless I stand a chance of bringing them back alive. Come on, Thompson. This is supposed to be a party, Nigel said. Stop giving the man a hard time.
Just making a point. I'm still not convinced this is the best way to deal with the Dyson pair. There's a strong body of opinion saying we should leave them well alone for a few centuries.
Yes,
Anna said. The guardians of selfhood, for one.
Thompson flashed her an angry look. Any news on them? Wilson asked Raphael Columbia. We've made over 200 arrests in connection with the raid, mostly black market arms merchants and other underworld military types. My chief investigator is confident they will provide us with enough information to finally track down the organizer.
He didn't sound impressed.
She seems to be doing a good job so far, Oscar said. There hasn't been a hint of trouble since the raid.
Sure that doesn't have anything to do with the level of CST security? Elaine Doy asked demurely.
Oscar raised his glass to her, ignoring the dark expression on Columbia's face. That's probably about 99% of the reason. Yeah, he conceded.
She looked around at the four crew members.
So, are you nervous? It would be stupid not to be, Wilson said. The fear factor is a significant part of our racial survival mechanism. Evolution doesn't like arrogance.
A healthy attitude. For myself, I wish there was some way of communicating with you. To be cut off from information seems barbaric somehow.
Wilson smiled a challenge at Nigel. I guess our best hyperspace theorists aren't quite up to that.
Nigel raised a glass but didn't take the bait.
That's the whole reason for me getting Wilson here to captain the mission. As they can't refer every decision back here for review by your committees, I wanted someone who could make a decent judgment call. Unless you'd like to go yourself, Vice President.
Elaine Doy glanced from Nigel to Wilson.
I'm satisfied that you're in charge of the mission, Captain.
If we had more than one ship, communications wouldn't be such an issue, Oscar said.
And who's going to pay for another ship? Thompson asked quickly. His gaze flicked to one of the big portals set up along the far side of the courtyard garden. They all showed various images of the Second Chance. The starship was docked to its assembly platform, though the outer shell of malmetal had peeled back to a thick toroid skirt around the gateway. Of all the construction gridwork, only a tripod of gantry arms remained, like an aluminum claw gripping the rear of the starship. Sunlight fell across the 400-meter length of the central cylindrical section snow-white hull, casting small gray shadows from every hatch, nozzle, grid, antenna, and handrail that stood above the protective cloak of foam. The huge life support ring was rotating slowly around it, almost devoid of windows, except for a few black rectangles along the front edge. Tiny colored navigation lights winked at various points on the superstructure. Otherwise, there was no visible activity. The sight of the massive vessel brought a flush of comfort to Wilson. Something that large, that solid, gave an overwhelming impression of dependability.
Any subsequent ships would be cheaper now we've finalized the design, Nigel said. CST is certainly considering the formation of a small exploration fleet. What the hell for? Thompson said. This expedition is bad enough, and we know something strange is out there. We don't need to go looking for trouble any farther out.
That's hardly the attitude that pushed us this far out into the galaxy, Senator. We're not a poor society, thanks to that outward urge. We should continue to push back the barriers.
Fine, Thompson said bluntly. You want them pushed back, you pay for them. You certainly won't have my support for further government funding. Look what happened with Far Away. We poured billions into that venture, and it still costs the government hundreds of millions a year. What have we ever got back out of it?
Knowledge, Wilson said, surprised to find himself defending Far Away.
Precious little of it, Thompson grunted. Tell that to the Halgarths. They dominate force field manufacture, thanks to the technology they acquired from the Marie Celeste.
What if we don't come back?
Anna asked. The way the council members all looked at her in a mildly scandalized silence made her want to giggle.
You have to admit, it's a possibility.
We won't abandon you, Elaine Doy said smoothly. If it is necessary to build another ship, then it will be done. She gave the North American senator a sharp frown as he gathered himself to speak. The Exoprotectorate Council has drawn up contingency plans for every possible scenario, Nigel Sheldon said, and quite a few implausible ones as well. As the Vice President says, every effort will be made should we face a worst-case outcome. Does that include military action? Now even Wilson was giving her a look.
I don't believe that's relevant, Raphael Columbia said.
It just strikes me as odd that very little is being done to beef up the Commonwealth's defenses, especially as one of the most plausible theories about the Dyson Barrier is that it's protective.
We are doing something about it, Raphael Columbia said. We're sending you to assess the situation.
And if it's bad?
We will respond accordingly.
With what? We haven't had any wars for 300 years.
There are 17 isolated planets, and each one was withdrawn from the Commonwealth because of military action. The last of those was only 20 years ago. Sad to say, our Commonwealth is actually quite experienced in such matters.
Those were guerrilla actions, mounted by nationalist and religious groups. Most of the Commonwealth citizens weren't even aware of them. What exactly is your point?
Elaine Doy asked, irritation creeping into her voice.
All I'm saying is, a few Alamo Avengers aren't going to be much use against anything that's seriously hostile out there. We know that. Your mission profile was drawn up with the possibility in mind, and I welcomed Captain Kime's input in the planning. Frankly, his cautious approach is one I favor, and to be realistic, if you do find anything as powerful and hostile as what you're talking about, then they're going to know about the Commonwealth anyway.
The band struck up a light waltz that Wilson felt he should know. But he was thankful for the distraction as everyone turned to look at the western sky. A particularly bright star was rising above the palace rooftop. They'd left the Second Chance in her highly elliptical orbit around Anshun. After all, the exact position made no difference to the wormhole gateway. Now, as she glided up high over the horizon, still exposed to the full radiance of Anshun's sun, she was the brightest object in the heavens. Fireworks zoomed over the palace to greet the starship, exploding in huge bursts of emerald, gold, and carmine with a cacophony of thundercracks. The courtyard was swiftly filled with the rapturous applause of the elite guests. A laser projector drenched Wilson in a bubble of white light. Everyone turned to look at him, the sound of their applause rising. He bowed graciously, gesturing Anna and Oscar into the light field as the senior members of the Exo-Protectorate Council sank away along with Tuli. Somehow Dudley Bowes managed to appear beside Oscar, clasping his hands victoriously above his head. When the fireworks were over, the band resumed a more traditional background piece. The buffet was opened, and people surged across the garden. Elaine Doy stepped forward again.
Captain, I just wanted to say, bon voyage.
Even when it was over, Wilson regretted having to attend the official party for the personal time it stole from him on the eve of the departure. By the time the buffet started, the affair had become immensely boring.
2 hours in, he'd seen Oscar making a quiet exit with some handsome young lad, and wished he could do the same with Anna. But they'd be noticed. He'd forgotten the true price of fame. There were compensations, however. At 8 o'clock this morning, he had arrived at the complex to walk through the gateway. Management staff, construction crew and technicians, designers, medical personnel, and 100 others lined the last length of path before the wormhole, all applauding as Wilson led the senior officers through the gateway. Now he was sitting in the bridge, about to embark on the voyage that would put him on the same list as Columbus, Armstrong, Sheldon, and Isaac. But not poor old Dylan Lewis. To be honest, he did consider the bridge to be a bit disappointing. Even the old Ulysses command cabin had been more visually exciting, let alone the bustling chambers of 1,000 Unisphere fantasy drama ships. It was a simple compartment with consoles for 10 people, although only 7 were currently manned. A glass wall separated off the senior officer's briefing room, basically a big conference table with 20 chairs. At least there were a couple of large high-res holographic portals in their traditional place on the forward wall, although, bad design this, the consoles right in front of them blocked the lower portion from anyone farther back. Not that he had much time for the standard images they were relaying from hull-mounted cameras. His virtual vision was on high intensity, while his retinal inserts were filtering out most natural light. The result was an almost indistinct room flooded with ship function icons. He rested his palms on the console eyespots, seeing phantom fingers materialize within the galaxy of graphics drifting through the air around him. When he tapped his customized chrome-yellow fingernail on the airlock icon, it expanded to show him the hull was now sealed. A simultaneous tap on the umbilicals told him all the tanks were full and on internal power. The only links to the platform were a high-band data cable and the mechanical latches.
"Crew status?" he asked Oscar. "Everyone on board and ready."
"Okay then. Pilot, please activate our force field and disengage us from the platform."
"Aye, sir," Jean Duvoir said. The pilot had spent decades working for several companies at the High Angel, flying engineering pods around the big freefall factories, shifting sections, massing hundreds of tons with the casual precision of a bird of prey. Before that, he'd helped develop control routines for space plane RI pilots. Coupled with his enthusiasm for the project, it was a background that made him perfect for the job. Wilson counted himself lucky to have someone so competent on board. A communications icon flashed in Wilson's virtual vision, tagging the call as Nigel Sheldon. He tapped for admission.
"Captain," Sheldon's voice sounded across the bridge, "I'm accessing your telemetry. It all looks good from where we are."
And here. There had been a great many of these pointless official talks on the Ulysses, too. All for posterity and media profile. One of his virtual vision digital readouts was showing the number of people accessing the moment through the Unisphere, in excess of 15 billion. "We're ready to go." His voice was somber and authoritative as the impact of the event finally hit home. One of the portals showed him a view of the 3 umbilical gantries swinging away from the starship's rear section, little silver-white fluid globules spilled out of the closed valves, sparkling in the sunlight as they wobbled off into space.
"Hopefully we'll see you again in a year's time," Nigel Sheldon said. "I look forward to it." "Godspeed, Captain."
Jean Duvoir fired the small thrusters around the rear of the central cylindrical section. Second Chance started to slide away from the gateway. Acceleration was so tiny, Wilson couldn't even feel it affect the low-gravity bridge. The dazzling turquoise flames of the thrusters shrank away and vanished.
"We're now at 5 meters per second," Duvoir reported. There was a lot of amusement in his voice.
"Thank you, pilot," Wilson said. "Hyperdrive, please bring the wormhole up to flight level."
"Aye, sir." Thule couldn't help the strong twang of excitement in her voice. She began to shunt instructions into the ship's RI that would handle the enormously complex energy manipulation functions. Wilson instructed his e-butler to shift down his virtual vision intensity and took his hands off the console eyespots. One hologram portal showed the assembly platform slowly shrinking behind them. The second had a small circular turquoise nebula glowing in the center. It began to expand,
growing more indistinct, although no stars were visible through it. "Course laid in?" Wilson asked.
"Want to consult our expert navigator on that?" Anna muttered under her breath. She still hadn't warmed up to Bowers.
Wilson ignored her, wondering if the rest of the bridge crew had overheard.
"As agreed," Oscar said.
He had his hands pressed firmly on his console eyespot, his eyes flicking quickly between virtual icons.
"First exit point, 25 light-years from Dyson Alpha."
"Wormhole opening stable, Captain,"
Tu Li reported.
"Inject us," Wilson told her.
The blue haze folded around Second Chance like petals closing for the night. Their data link to the assembly platform and the Unisphere ended. Both portals showed the starship bathing in the wormhole's pale moonlight radiance of low-level radiation. Oscar canceled the camera feeds. The bridge portals switched to displaying the gravitonic spectrum, sensors around the ship detecting faint echoes resonating within the wormhole. It was a crude version of radar that allowed them to locate stars and planets to a reasonable degree, but that was all. For truly accurate sensor work, they needed to drop out into real space.
Wilson upped his virtual vision again, taking another sweep of the starship's primary systems. Everything was humming along sweetly.
He came out and checked around the bridge. The engineers were all still heavily integrated with the ship's RI, monitoring the performance of their respective fields, but everyone else was already relaxing. Wilson glanced inquisitively at Oscar, who put on a contented expression as he sat back. There wasn't much left for them to do. Not for another 130 days.